Chapter 19 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 19. To return to Oscar's trial. He was convicted and sentenced to 2 years' hard labour by Mr. Justice Wills. He was very unlucky, because I knew for a fact that if the jury had not disagreed at his first trial, and if he had then been convicted, Mr. Justice Charles would have given him 6 months. When Mr. Frank Harris, in his Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, is not inventing fairy tales about me, he often says things that I cordially agree with and endorse. I do entirely agree with him that the sentence of 2 years' hard labour passed on Oscar Wilde by Mr. Justice Wills was cruel and outrageous. I invite anyone who disagrees, or pretends to disagree, with me to look up the records of sentences passed for similar offences any time during the last 35 years. I doubt if he will find a single instance of a man getting so terrible a sentence unless there were greatly aggravating circumstances. Détournement de mineur, or brutalisation, or cases of master and pupil, for example. As Harris points out, it was never even suggested by a peculiarly fierce and vindictive prosecution that Oscar had corrupted any single one of his victims. In fact, they were not victims at all. One and all were accomplices, and should have been in the dock with him if there were any prosecution at all. As a matter of fact, all the evidence was obtained by giving the victims the choice between giving evidence or being prosecuted themselves. The choice was also offered to Alfred Taylor. He was visited by the late Inspector Littlechild of Scotland Yard, who assured him that if he would give evidence against Wilde, he would be safe. I had this information at the time, and it was recently confirmed to me by Mr. Newton, the solicitor who appeared for Taylor. To his lasting credit, Taylor refused to give evidence against Oscar Wilde, and preferred to go, as he did, to 2 years' hard labour, rather than, by betraying his friend, to sully his honour, which, to my mind, remains, from this very fact, far brighter than that of many of those who helped to hound Oscar Wilde to his doom. All the other witnesses, with one exception, of whom more anon, gave evidence to save their skins. Of course, if they had all refused to give evidence, as this one did, the case would have collapsed. I mean that this case differed from most others of the kind, in which there is an injured prosecutor, a father or guardian, and at least one real victim. All this is very important because, after all, there is such a thing as justice and fair play, even in the case of Oscar Wilde. That sounds a commonplace now, when he has been turned by his misguided admirers into a martyr and a hero. But at the time when these things happened, I was the one and only man in England who openly and publicly stuck up for him, and declined to back down or yield an inch to popular clamour. It is perhaps hardly necessary for me to say that the idea of acting otherwise than I did never even occurred to me for a moment. Perhaps if I had been able to guess that years later I was to lose a case for libel in which I was accused of abandoning Wilde and ruining him and deserting him, and that my accusers were to be Wilde's most intimate soi-disant friends, who would produce Wilde's own posthumous abuse of me, penned at the very time when I was suffering exile, obloquy, poverty and disgrace on his behalf, and out of my loyalty to him, I might have been tempted to think twice before committing myself so completely as I did to his cause. But at the time I had no thought but to carry out the solemn promise I had given him that I would stick to him through thick and thin, and that neither bribes nor threats would move me an inch from my determination that when he came out of prison he should find me exactly the same as I was when he last saw me a few weeks before his conviction. From this determination I never moved. As I have already explained, at that time I had no religion at all, and very little moral sense. It never occurred to me as conceivable that it would be right for me to give up Wilde. To do so, on the contrary, would have appeared to me dishonourable, cowardly, mean, and disgraceful. The idea that it would have been a moral act to disown him and make terms with his enemies, chief of whom was my father, never presented itself to my mind. Nor do I even now consider that it would have been anything but dishonourable and cowardly on my part to abandon him. I had, of course, the opportunity for a very good get-out, if I had cared to avail myself of it, when, after he had been about 9 months in prison, I was told by Ross that Oscar had turned against me, that he now spoke of me with bitterness and dislike, that he did not want to have any letter from me, and in fact stated categorically that I was on no account to write to him, and that I was to hand over any letters of his I had to Ross. Instead of doing what I might have done, and saying, "Oh, very well, of course, if he does not desire my friendship, there is no object in going on making myself into a martyr and a pariah on his account," I determined all the more to stick to him. I said to Ross, in effect, "I don't care what you say. It may be true that Oscar has turned against me, but that is probably only because he is half mad as a result of his sufferings in prison, and in any case, whether he has turned against me or not, I have not turned against him. I promised him on my most sacred word that I would stick to him, and I shall go on doing it. When he comes out of prison, if he chooses to say he does not want my friendship, and that he wants his letters back, he can do so with his own mouth. But in the meanwhile, I am not taking any advice or any messages from you, nor shall I give you any of Oscar's letters, and you can mind your own damned business and leave me to mind mine." I believe Ross's hatred of me and a subconscious determination to get even with me, although he went on pretending to be my friend, began from the moment when I gave him this answer to his attempt to interfere between Wilde and me and to obtain possession of Wilde's letters. I have no doubt now at all, though I never dreamed of such a thing at the time, that he deliberately poisoned Wilde against me at this time by misrepresenting my attitude and my actions, and I have no doubt that he acted out of jealousy. Before I leave the subject of Oscar's trial and conviction, I will explain my allusion, a few pages back, to the one witness who, after giving a proof of his evidence to the prosecution, declined to bear it out in the witness box. This youth was a gentleman by birth, and of an entirely different character and class to the other witnesses. He was terrorised into making a statement against Wilde. I am not suggesting that what he alleged may not have been true, by the same means as the other victims. I happened to see him in the corridor at Bow Street Police Court while he was waiting to give evidence. I went up and shook hands with him and said, "Surely you are not going to give evidence against Oscar?" He looked round in a frightened way and then whispered, "Well, what can I do? I daren't refuse to give evidence now. They got a statement out of me." I said, "For God's sake, remember you are a gentleman and a public schoolboy. Don't put yourself on a level with scum like blank and blank, two of the witnesses. When counsel asks you the questions, deny the whole thing and say you made the statement because you were frightened by the police. They can't do anything to you." He grabbed my hand and said, "All right, I'll do what you say." He did. More power to him. To the consternation of prosecuting counsel, he denied his own statement and swore that Wilde had never been anything to him but a good friend. Counsel, of course, dropped him like a hot brick. He was told to stand down and walked out of the court having inflicted a very nasty jolt to the prosecution, of which an intelligent counsel, if such a one had been appearing for Wilde, would have made tremendous use. I do not think it fair to give this young man's name, but a reference to the reports in the papers of the case would of course reveal it. I would not mention it if I did not think that what he did was greatly to his credit and perfectly justifiable. If all the other witnesses had replied in the same way, and by stating the fact that they only gave their evidence because it was a choice between the witness box and the dock, the whole case would have been shooed out of court in a very short time, and one of the greatest and most far-reachingly disastrous scandals that ever afflicted this country would have been nipped in the bud. End of chapter 19.